So welcome back to episode 2, second half of our top 20 on the biggest DeFi projects. I'm here once again with Sue and Arthur. And if you haven't listened to the first part where we introduce Arthur and talk about all projects, DEX category and spot lending and synthetics lending, then go back and listen to that first. Otherwise, welcome back. Today we will cover kind of like, we call them token bridges. So basically bridging kind of assets between different blockchains or between bank accounts and blockchains, basically tokenizing stuff. And then we have a category that's sort of money games, which we get to. And then basically the three projects in the top 20 that didn't really fit into any category of their own. So we have Yearn, and Nexus Mutual, and Loopring. So welcome back, you two. And let's start with the bridges.
So the first bridge I think that we're gonna talk about is REN, and their flagship asset is REN BTC. So REN BTC, REN was actually initially called launched ICO, I think in early 2018 as a Republic protocol. Initially, you want to do like a dark pool for decentralized trading, but I think after a while, they pivoted to instead of doing like a trustless asset bridge for other asset, like starting for Bitcoin, and also like they have other assets as well. But I think the Bitcoin, the REN BTC is the most successful one right now. And I think that the approach taken by them is a very useful and pragmatic approach, because I think that there's a huge demand to use Bitcoin in the DeFi ecosystem, or just in the Ethereum ecosystem in general. And the other solution when they were launching is REN BTC, which is like a centralized solution, which I think you guys talked about in the previous podcast. And so REN BTC is supposedly the more decentralized version of a Bitcoin on Ethereum blockchain, and is done using like a what they call a cryptographic method called secure multi-party computation, SMPC, to solve this, to make it trusted, so you can verify that there is a real Bitcoin backing this REN BTC, or using the cryptographic method. So I think that has been fairly successful since the launch. The REN BTC has probably like the second highest BTC, like synthetic REN BTC on Ethereum blockchain. The first one is REN BTC. It got it into the curve pool and gotten quite a decent amount of liquidity. And it's kind of interesting that how REN BTC seems like the favorite coin for a lot of the DeFi hackers to get away with. They usually convert their gains to Ethereum, then to REN BTC, and then convert from REN BTC to the real Bitcoin. And I'm not sure what happened to that afterwards, but seems like quite a number of the hacker, like exploiter of DeFi, have used that route to get their money out from the system. And beyond that, I think that the value capture is okay. I think that it's decent, but I think that the number seems like it's because it takes like a certain percentage of fee for every conversion. Like if you wrap your Bitcoin into a REN BTC, you pay like one basis point, and vice versa when you unwrap. So the key challenge is what will happen to the fee if a lot of the REN BTC is just not gonna go through back and forth. I mean, once they enter the Ethereum ecosystem, they're just gonna stay there and not gonna be converted out anymore. So then the fee value capture on this part will be a little bit weak in that sense. And there was also some controversy about the current stage of decentralization on trustless AI. I mean, I'm not the expert in this, but there are some who say that currently they are not really using the real SMPC yet. It's like probably not like peer review or open source. I'm not the expert on this, but I heard some about this. But so far it's been doing pretty well among all the cross-chain or bridges project. I think it's definitely doing, it's probably the most successful so far if you count REN BTC out.
Yeah, I agree with the characterization as a WBTC competitor. also because they sort of disagree with the characterization of it being trustless. So I'm also not an expert on this, but I think that the right way to think about multi-party computation is basically just an implementation of multi-signature, right? So it's sort of like a consortium where you have different machines in the Wren office or wherever they store it, but controlling all or holding all the actual BTC in custody and then issuing Wren BTC against it on Ethereum. But they can kind of change this at any time. I think they have full control over it. Yeah, so I don't actually see this as trustless. I see it right now as fully custodial, which might be totally fine, right? So you can, Tether is fully custodial, right? But its value proposition is regulatory arbitrage. And that's kind of the bracket where I put Wren BTC into right now. And it's kind of proven by all the hackers using it to cash out their BTC. And so far, the Wren team has never stopped any of those withdrawals, although they could, and that alone shows that it's custodial. They do want to go, I think, in the future into a direction that's a bit more like tBTC. So you have kind of fidelity bonds, right? So for the different nodes that custody the key shards of those Bitcoin. So you would then have a protocol that watches the behavior of the custodians, and they have to put up a bond. And when they misbehave, for example, they deny a withdrawal or they withdraw coins that don't have authorization, then their bond would be confiscated. So that's I think a possible direction for Wren to go, but it has this trade-off, right? If you want your custodians to put up additional bonds, then the system will become more expensive to you. So I actually think it's necessary for them to start with this custodial way, because if the system was expensive to use right from the start, then I think it would be way harder to build the necessary network effect and liquidity for this token so that users might eventually be willing to pay like this kind of upcharge for additional security. Does any of you know much about Terra?
Yes. I'll talk about Terra. I actually have a pretty decent understanding of it. So I think Terra was actually was an ICO launched in 2018. Actually, they raised a fair amount of money. And I think one of the reasons is because like the co-founder, one of them is like a fairly successful entrepreneur in the Korea e-commerce market. He launched one of the biggest e-commerce startup in Korea called Tmon, Ticket Monster. So I think that gave him a lot of credentials to launch this and to launch like a decentralized stablecoin protocol built on a Cosmos SDK. So you can think of them as part of the Cosmos ecosystem. And the concept is pretty similar to the first initial design of Haven, actually, like a precursor to Synthetix. Basically, that what happened is like the user of the stablecoin will pay a fee to the Terra token holder to providing this stability services. I think that concept as a whole is very sound, but I think on the like detail on it, like how do you maintain the price stability and the peg, we won't go too deep into this, but there are some small challenges into it. But basically, I think that the general concept is sound, that you're paying the Terra, the Luna token holder, for sort of right, providing some backstop to the stablecoin, but also providing the stability to that. So, but in a way, you can think of it in a real world circumstances on a payment. When you're using Visa and MasterCard for payment, like the merchant are paying like 2% to Visa and MasterCard for helping them to process this transaction. So the logic, I think on that level, is very sound.
I mean, in a blockchain, I guess I get why you can't do it kind of with in a regulated environment with Visa and MasterCard, but in a blockchain environment, can't you just wrap the payment token and then transact with that? So the underlying kind of Terra coin or whatever it's called doesn't move?
Yeah, I think that is definitely a way to get around with it. But again, that I think that the crux is like the network effect of the original stablecoin is so strong that your wrap version will not be able to overcome it. So there's definitely a lot of effort that we need to go to build the network effect and the distribution channel for that original version of the Terra stablecoin, so that even if a person wrap it, you will not get accepted anywhere. And the main use case of Terra stablecoin has always been in the Korea commerce scene, I think mainly some e-commerce. So they actually, if you measure it by some metric, they have the largest amount of fee paid to use a protocol because they have a Chai app that in Korea, you can download the app and use it to pay for a lot of the e-commerce services. I mean, they have some way to get around it so that the user are actually not using the stablecoin. But in a way, they are using the stablecoin. I'm not sure the exact detail. I don't really use it before.
Mm-hmm.
But that actually lead to some new fee generation for the Terra validator and staker. So
yeah.
They generated a fair amount of fee, and the daily user is pretty impressive. I think that they have more than 1.5 million of total registered user, and daily user is like, I think 15,000-ish, I think, or slightly more. I can't recall the exact number, but it's probably the most successful if you measure it by real-world adoption in terms of payment. So the Korean user through the Chai app are using a Terra protocol for the payment services and interacting with the stablecoin in some indirect method. But I think that and they are trying to get into DeFi right now. I think that what they realized that they spent a lot of effort to build the commerce adoption in Korea, and actually they want to expand to Southeast Asia as well. But it's the real world move way slower than the crypto world. So I think that they're recognizing that right now, and they're actually trying to move into the DeFi space by doing some, I think they launched a new thing called the Mirror Protocol. I think they partnered with some of the other Cosmos ecosystem project. And I think that with the launch of the Cosmos IBC, they might be able to interop with each other. So I think it's doing fairly well. It's just that their approach is not so crypto native compared to most of the, probably all the other DeFi protocol we are talking about right now. So yeah, I think that it has a good amount of success in the mainstream space.
Something I didn't understand yet. So the Terra stablecoin, is it backed by dollars in a bank, or what is it backed by?
It's actually backed by the Luna token. So it's a little bit of synthetics. Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah,
okay.
It's backed by the Luna token. If again, I'm not an expert, but I think that's how it works. And the fee that go to the Luna token is what make the Luna token valuable.
I see. Okay, gotcha. Anything on Terra, Sue?
Yeah, I don't really consider it DeFi per se. I mean, it's definitely like crypto and then finance, but I'm not sure if it's full DeFi just because of the way that it's not really interop with anything that's currently in DeFi. And then also, there's the way that the original token sale for Terra was done. I think it's makes it quite a different project. I mean, it's kind of got this interesting thing, right, where it's a Korean project, but then it has this like very long list of investors that are like standard crypto funds. I never quite understood that, but I think maybe that's a product of the time that it was conceived in. But with that said, yeah, it's impressive the adoption that they have. I'm not sure the business model for the idea of the coin is that proven, but we'll have to see.
Thought chain, I think it's a bridge like RAN BTC, but also has some elements of an exchange like Uniswap. It both tokenizes different coins, and I don't really know how it works. And then you can trade these coins on sort of an off-chain exchange. Or is it not actually off-chain because they do have their own blockchain, right?
Yeah. So again, okay, I'm not the expert in this. I try my best to explain how it works. I think that how it works is like, I think from a user perspective, you have a key group of validator that they're actually putting up more RUNE, the native token of TorChain, as the collateral to backstop the interoperability of it, so that you can actually go from like a native token to the native token directly without using the wrapped version. So let's say you want to change from Bitcoin to Litecoin, you can actually use TorChain to do so. Like it's a little bit like a shapeshift, a decentralized version of shapeshift, like launched by Eric Wu, he's a Bitcoiners, OG Bitcoiners. And I think how they achieved it is using the economic guarantee. Like there's always more RUNE backing the collateral being it's because they're using an AMM as well, but they have their own version of like a CLP model of AMM that are providing liquidity for this. But there was always more RUNE backing the AMM asset so that you are not that worried that you will be like corrupted or what, or like be attacked, because like they have more to lose if something happened. But yeah, you can change from like a Bitcoin to Litecoin or to like a Bitcoin Cash directly using Torchain. I think that is the vision. Like, it saves all the wrapping hassle, and the value capture is supposedly very strong. Like, you, all the fee will go to the Rune token staker and validator. Yeah, I think that that's my understanding of it. And I think that it has a very strong community as well, quite similar to Synthetix in a way, that propelled it to a very monstrous game this year, although it's still in the testnet. But yeah, but it has been fairly successful if you measure it by a price action and the performance of the token so far.
Yeah, I think Rune's an interesting project. Definitely seemed a bit hype-centric when it first came out, but I think that the bridging liquidity design that they have is definitely unique, and they have a first mover advantage there as well. It just remains to be seen what it'll actually look like in mainnet. So I think it's hard to really speculate about it as a project until actually you can actually play with it and it works.
Okay, so moving on to the final asset, which is Reserve.
I think one thing, the most impressive thing about it is actually they spent a lot of effort at an earlier stage of their protocol to analyze all the different pros and cons of the different stablecoin model. And in the end, they figure out that all of them have some key issues, so that they come up with their own model. They adopt a gradual decentralization model, where initially, I think the Reserve, the stablecoin, the ISV, is actually backed by an actual dollar in the cash, but they plan to gradually decentralize it to make it backed by the Reserve Right token itself. And I think one thing that set themselves apart from other stablecoin or bridge protocol is that actually they actually want to push forward for the adoption in the developing country first. And actually, I think they spent a lot of effort in Venezuela to get the user there to adopt stablecoin with a pretty noble mission, I would say, because we all know that what kind of situation that Venezuela is in right now, and they do need a stable currency. And I think they've been spending quite a fair amount of effort to penetrate Venezuela in terms of getting their stablecoin become like a kind of de facto currency instead of their own Venezuela, Bolivia. I'm not sure how successful that has been, but they definitely have a very impressive list of backers earlier on. So yeah, that's all I know.
Yeah, I'm just going through the documentation right now on the other screen, and it says the protocol is supposed to have three phases. So first, the centralized phase, where every token is backed by a small number of collateral tokens, each of which is tokenized US dollar, and then a decentralized phase where Reserve is backed by changing basket of assets in a decentralized way, but it's still like it's more than 100% backed in every phase. And then the independent phase, where they want to launch their own unit of account, so it's no longer pegged to the dollar. Okay, so that's a pretty ambitious goal to build a network effect for that.
Yeah, and their backers are like probably the top investor list in crypto for the Civic. In terms of when you look at the investor list, like they have a Peter Thiel, they have a Sam Altman, they have like a lot of the top like Silicon Valley investor in their list. Yeah,
I guess that they changed their goals or their architecture pretty radically, because this what I just read is nothing like what I first read about them in like 2018 when I looked into them. So It's interesting to see them still stick around here.
Yeah, but I think that they are probably one of the few DeFi protocol that don't really consider them DeFi. I mean, I have never seen them trying to interop with other DeFi protocol, or like trying to work together with any of the DeFi protocol that we have mentioned so far. Yep.
So now next is a category that's has a bunch of different things. So let's hop, I guess, into Yearn. Yearn is sort of a grassroots ecosystem with the main goal to allow users to deposit coins and then invest those coins in a way that the user can just set and forget. I'd be curious to hear what you think about them.
I think that Yearn is the definitely, like, I think among all the different DeFi protocol that emerged this summer, it's definitely, you can say that it captured the most amount of attention and also have the most meteoric price action on the way up, and also when it comes down, it's also pretty volatile. And I think that the key, I think that is just that when you put in the DeFi perspective, it's a little bit like I'm saying this not to like offend the Bitcoiners, but I do think it shared a little bit kind of like a genesis with like how Bitcoin was being born. Like it was a fair launch. I mean, yes, Andre Cogne is the, he's not a non, but the whole fair launch method has captured a lot of people's imagination on how a DeFi protocol can launch without the like a VC involvement, can be a pretty grassroots and community run kind of a DeFi protocol and still be fairly successful. And I think that if we're just focusing on this aspect, and they've been fairly successful in that. And I think the coin distribution right now is also fairly distributed. We actually know a few big Wi-Fi farmer that farm more than 1,000 Wi-Fi, and they actually sold most of it before it hit 10,000. So the distribution is actually, I think, quite distributed right now. And I think half of the supply is actually in the central exchange right now. So I think a lot of people have actually sold and bought it on and off again. So in that sense, is you can say it's a little bit like a Bitcoin of DeFi, although that it's not money. The founders say it's a worthless governance token, but everyone knows that it's not really worthless because people are willing to pay $22,000 for one Wi-Fi. I think that is interesting. The first version of the product is really to be a U aggregator, because there's so much new like a U coming up. Like you have Aave, you have Compound, we have also a Curve as well. So like for average user, it's very daunting to just interact with all of them alone. So that you use Ian, you can just solve all of your issues. Like they just help you aggregate and find the best U for you. And the founder built this to use it himself. And obviously he doesn't want to govern the project, and he launched a token to decentralize the governance process. And I think that that product has been quite successful for the first 1 to 2 months. And after that, I think there's a new other they did not move fast enough to catch up with the new U farm. So I think the new some other new U farming vehicle actually takes some of the TVL away. And I think that even right now, I think that they are still trying to figure out a scalable way to run this U aggregation strategy, because when the U is lower than a certain level, people are just not going to do it anymore, because they actually you need to pay a performance fee and management fee for using the Yuan WAO. And I think that right now is the key challenges is that if you're talking about this U aggregation strategy alone, the key question to ask is it even possible to get a market neutral strategy that is also scalable at the same time, but yet achieve probably a double digit APR consistently? I think this is actually quite challenging and difficult. And I think that version of the product I think that right now is it's doing okay. It has a 400 million of TVL, but it has not really been growing for some period of time. But they are trying to go for a more ecosystem play method. They are collaborating with a lot of the other DeFi protocol that one of them we mentioned in the previous podcast, which is SushiSwap, and also a lot of other smaller ones like Pickle and others as well. I can't really recall all the names. So, and I think it's shaping out a bit like a kingmaker of DeFi in a sense, especially for the more fair launch, a non grassroots community driven coin. They can actually when to collaborate with the coin, and I think they can bring a lot of value to the table on how are they going to run the DAO and the whole protocol and some synergy they can explore. I think that kind of become like a not so pure play anymore. That actually there's more to yearn right now. I mean, and it can become whatever the community wanted to become in a way. So I think it's a pretty special protocol, but it's also make it quite hard to value right now. And it's even among the DeFi coin, it's also among the more volatile one, and it's kind of like a trader's favorite. Like the traders really like to trade around because it's very liquid and it also moves. So I think that's the state of yen. It's definitely one of the top DeFi protocol, but I think that it's quite hard to define what it is right now. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Wi-Fi, I think more so than any other coin of the DeFi summer, definitely a kind of a 0-1 moment really, where I kind of heard a funny phrase today, which was that this coin is so fair that I had to ape in as early as possible, which is kind of ironic to me in the idea that, you know, it's because it's so fair, it's such a good buy at an early stage. And I think that Wi-Fi really created this fair launch meme. The idea that you can have a DeFi protocol which 100% of the coins are going to the users, by some predefined metric and then see what happens. And I think there's a there's a cardinality effect that is achieved by being the first to do that properly, which is that, like Arthur said, it's like the Bitcoin on DeFi. It's the Bitcoin it's like you have the 30K cap, which I'm glad they did because that was contested for a while, but it gave it a very commodity-like trading style where you know that there was never any emissions. So in theory, if all the holders now just believe it's worth $1 million, it's going to go to $1 million, right? That'll just happen mathematically. But in practice, a lot of them will sell as it goes up. So it has that commodity fixed supply thing that makes it very good to trade. And it has the kind of mythical Genesis story, which gives it an allure that is harder to replicate, even if you have a project that does the same thing, but kind of is launched after Wi-Fi. So I think it's got that. But like Arthur said, you know, it yield aggregation is a tough game in the longer term because you don't really know what fees will be paid and how those will be received. And also, like, longer term, if you don't have inflation, then it will become harder to incentivize people to join the network because they would have to buy coins to then have a governance vote as opposed to earn them. So you could have some issues with ossification from that.
I guess you could use your cash flows a lot of cash flows, right?
You could
use those to buy up supply from the market.
Yeah, you could do that. You could do that. There's a number of ways you can do it. I mean, I think Wi-Fi holds a central role in DeFi, so people use it as a DeFi ETF as well. So that's why you see the trading volumes are enormous on Binance, on Coinbase. But it's also very much a bet on Andre as well, because Andre, being the sort of volatile, mythical figure that he is, kind of is the embodiment of Wi-Fi himself. So it's definitely a bet on him and continued innovation and composability. So I think, you know, when people first analyzed Wi-Fi, they looked at it from the pure yield aggregation play perspective, and they didn't really understand why it had any value because you could just do the same thing. And they kind of didn't understand the cultural context of that project as it was launching. So I think that prestige is actually, it is very Bitcoin-like in the DeFi ecosystem. And I think it will likely to retain some of that prestige value over time. Just a matter of like what innovations will they bring to also give cash flow values to the users and to the holders.
I've been going through different stages with Yuan in terms of like liking or not liking it. I liked it a lot in the very beginning because, same as Compound, it brought a lot of new innovation to the DeFi space. That when it's one of those projects, if you tell people from outside of DeFi about it, then that's kind of what makes it click for them, the things that you can do, right? This whole kind of super fluid collateral thesis, where we touched on this in the last podcast as well, but where Jörn was consistent of so many layers of basically tokenized balances that you could earn yields in several different protocols at the same time, all in a kind of set and forget nature. So it's really highly capital efficient. And at the same time, it's completely like trustless and auditable. And I think that really highlights the power of the things that you can do in DeFi and that you can do with composability. But then after kind of this like first magic kind of wore off, then I saw that the people working on Yearn didn't actually care about the user. It felt like they cared more about like tinkering, like different stuff, constantly rewriting how the project worked. And that's when you saw that, like, you kind of noticed that there were like huge yield farming opportunities in DeFi, and they just didn't offer them for their users, even though kind of the market demand was there and it was huge. And projects like Harvest went over like $1 billion of deposits when Yuan was like at 200, even though Jørn had the capability to do this in a trustless way, and Harvest was actually almost until the end was completely custodial, right? So it was controlled by a single admin key, like $1 billion, right? And there was this fun exchange between, I think, you, Sue, and the founder of Harvest about stealing $1 billion. And they said, like, who needs $1 billion as the reason why they would have no incentive to steal it. I feel that was actually where I got really mad with them and actually sold my coins, when they just refused to adopt new vaults and new strategies. I think they now are at a point where they have started to add new strategies and kind of move a bit faster. But yeah, that's kind of the downside of this super fair launch approach, where you just have no people really incentivized to work on it. And the governance sort of so decentralized that it's really becomes really hard to innovate.
Yeah. I need to add one thing though. I think that the core group contributor did indeed form about Yen, and they are actually getting paid for working on Yen as well right now. But I think that for a decentralized fair launch protocol, you kind of still need a person to act as a leader. I'm not sure who is the leader right now. It's probably Bantech, or I'm not sure whether it's still Andre. I don't think he is. I think without a leader figure, when it comes to some difference in opinion, are you going to go for voting every time? I think it's not the best way of resolving some key issue, especially if only the insider know it better than anyone else. So I think that's also probably one of the challenges of a decentralized community-run protocol.
Yeah, exactly. So that's kind of the managerial role that was kind of missing from Jørn, because I carried kind of my what I thought was constructive criticism to the team, and the answer that you got was, if you want it, then write it yourself. That's what we tell everyone. And I mean, that's not really how you run a business. Right? So they didn't really care what the user wanted. They had their own idea of what was interesting and fun to work on, and that's what they did. So, but I think they are really turning it around right now. So like the criticism that I brought forward, I don't think it's really valid anymore, just giving my perspective on what really soured this protocol for me for a couple of months. So moving on to Nexus Mutual, it's one of two, or maybe one of three big insurance protocols, the other two being Cover, and then there's one Asian one that I don't know all that much about. So let's talk about how Nexus Mutual works and what it does.
Sure. So I think Nexus Mutual is fairly straightforward. It's like it's a mutual, which means that it's a member-based a pool, and it's being an insurance pool that every members contribute the capital and have a claim on the capital pool, but also providing the coverage for people who want to insure against them. And in exchange, they share the premium proportionally to how much capital pool they contribute. So it's a fairly ancient concept, and just applying it to DeFi. And I think it works in a sense that if you want to purchase any insurance for the DeFi protocol or the smart contract insurance, Nexus Mutual is insuring, yeah, you can go and do it, and it works. Yeah. So I think in that sense, you can say it pioneered the approach of providing insurance for smart contract, which is definitely a big issue in DeFi and in Ethereum as well. And I think it has been quite successful in getting that objective achieved, which is to provide insurance coverage for users who want to interact with different smart contracts. I think that you can definitely say it's fairly successful, and the founder, the team also is fairly legit, have a very credible profile. They work as actuaries and work in the insurance space before. Very solid insurance protocol. But I do think that recently is losing, probably not the right way to describe it, but I think that the way that the whole pricing model is designed, the bonding curve, it's actually there's a lot of second order effect on the price and on the people who contribute the capital to become a Nexus Mutual member, because at 100% MCR, I forgot what MCR stands for, I think
minimum capital ratio, I think.
You can't redeem your Nexus Mutual token for the capital, which is ETH anymore. So you will have your capital stuck, and the only way you can sell it is you wrap it into a wrap Nexus Mutual and sell it on exchange. And that is actually, a lot of people don't think it will happen, but it did happen, and it's still there. Currently, it's still 100%, which means that you can't redeem your Nexus Mutual through the bonding curve. And as a result, wrap Nexus Mutual trade at a very substantial discount to the actual Nexus Mutual. I think it's around 30% or more. I think 30%+ right now, which kind of, I think, it affect the confidence of some of the members, because in a way that they didn't realize that they can actually get trapped inside the capital pool, or they need to sell it at like a 30-40% discount on the open market. And I think that actually this issue is not an issue if you're coming in from a user perspective of using the protocol, because yes, you still get your insurance coverage and you still get a payout if your claims is the right claims. But from a member perspective, I think that kind of make a lot of people will think twice before providing the capital in the future, especially for bigger holder, because it's actually quite illiquid and it doesn't give them the flexibility to really enter and exit, not even in a short time, but I mean over like a more reasonable medium time frame. Yep.
Could you describe, for someone who would maybe be interested in getting insurance on some DeFi protocol that they are using, how does the claims process work? Who decides if you're getting paid out or not?
I think right now, I think for Nexus Mutual, it's a bit of a debate and a little bit of a, I don't think there's a formal on-chain way. I'm not 100% sure. Probably there's some voting, but it's pretty arbitrary. I think there's no like a formal kind of like a methodology, but it's a bit more of like a, I think voting by the member and also combine some of the expert opinion from the team as well, because I mean, they have all have insurance background as well. So it's not a guaranteed payout, but so far they have paid out some claims successfully before.
Do you think there's a way to do this in a completely trustless way? So, I mean, we are operating with smart contracts after all, right? So isn't there some condition that you can define that is like definitely a hack, or, and then kind of people can 100% rely that the insurance will pay out?
I think that yes, it can be fairly trustless, but it will not be like 100% trustless, because you need to rely on an oracle. And in this situation, the oracle is even harder to define, because how are you going to define an oracle for a hack, right? Because it has to go through a human to decide that, oh, we think that this is a hack, so that we agree to pay out the claim. So even on the definition alone, that you can debate for a fair amount of time on that. So I think that it can go fairly trustless, but it will not be like a fully trustless, purely run by code kind of way. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So Loopring is a first DEX in Ethereum to adopt a ZK rollup, and when it was and it's a I can you can say it's a quite a big success in that sense, that they are the first to adopt a ZK rollup layer 2 solution. And when they do the process of starting the ZK rollup, I think that it was quite a lot of buy in from a lot of people in the community, and because it's the first practical implementation, and it works right now, because you can use the ZK rollup of a Loopring for both the DEX trading and also for transfer. I think the transfer part is not really the initial objective, but it's just that because it's so cheap to transfer on layer 2, they kind of say that, you know, why not we also advertise this benefit as well, because you can transfer from 2 different accounts in the ZK rollup with a very, very low cost and very quick as well. So I think that's kind of some expansion of the scope. And I think they were an order book based model, because if you're using ZK rollup, it's quite cheap, the gas cost and the performance is quite good, so you don't really need to use an AMM. But I think the challenge is order book model is not that good for bootstrapping liquidity for DEX. I think they're actually going to offer AMM DEX for Loopring as well instead of a pure order book model. So I think in that sense, the ZK rollup, the technical implementation is definitely very successful. But I think in terms of running a DEX, their volume is not really in the top 10 right now. And even the user, I think it's okay, but I wouldn't say you can call it like a very successful. And I think, but one thing unique about Loopring is also one of the very few team where the team is actually based in Asia, a big part of the team, an engineering team. Yeah, which is, I think it's it shows that there are some DeFi team in Asia as well. So yeah, and they're technically they are pretty solid, but they're just pretty under the radar and pretty low profile in a sense. Yeah.
What do you see as the challenge for basically those launching a new layer two solution like Loopring? I mean, if I look at this, I'm asking myself, so what is actually the incentive to deposit any tokens there? Like, right? So don't you have the kind of chicken egg problem?
Yeah, exactly. I think this is a big issue right now, and it will get worse next year if a lot of the layer two launch and we don't really get a consensus of which one that we are going to use. I think this, it's going to be a pretty chaotic situation. I think that from what we learned in the DeFi summer, incentive works. I think that actually some of the layer two solutions should actually experience like a usage mining in a way that you give people some incentive to try it out, to use the layer two solution, and to also to incentivize the other protocol to build on top of you as well. So you gain the network effect. And I think it becomes a bit like a game theory that which one are you going to adopt? Like right now, it's basically the middle and the smaller DeFi protocol are all waiting for the bigger protocol to make a first move before they make a move. Because if they move and the bigger one move to another one, it's quite pointless. You lose all the composability. So it's a bit like a chicken game right now. And I think that the layer two team can probably do something to nudge them. Again, I think that's just my idea, and it's definitely not an easy problem to solve, but I do believe that incentive goes a pretty long way to help to tackle this issue.
Yeah, right. Usage mining sounds like a very viable solution to this problem, right? Given that Loopring already has a token, and I assume it earns some kind of fee from...
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. One thing about Ring is the user do get some fee from the trading volume. I think that's if you become a Loopring staker, I think you get a pretty substantial percentage of the fee that going through the Loopring exchange. But it's all just because the Loopring exchange doesn't do that much volume. There's not much fee to be distributed right now.
So then we move on to our final category. We were kind of debating before this podcast if this should even be included as a DeFi coin. But CoinGecko includes it, so we will talk about it. And it's very popular right now. So it's the kind of Ponzi game / money games, empty set dollar, ESD, and ample forth. So Arthur, could you describe how those work and why they are so popular right now?
Yeah, I'm probably not the best person to explain this. But I try my best. MT set dollar is a algorithmic stable coin that use a novel economic incentive to incentivize the price to be stable. Right now, the target is to be stable around $1 over a medium to long term. And they bake in a lot of economic incentive to bootstrap the initial network effect so that people are going to participate in bootstrapping the network at the beginning. So the incentive of being early is extremely high if the ESD market cap did end up expanding, which it did. So I think when it gets started, it obviously started from zero. And right now it's at around 500 million market cap. And when you think about it, it's actually quite insane because that's actually the maker market cap as well. Okay, it's getting close. It's 430 right now, but it was like 500 yesterday. So it went from zero to 500 million, I think, in 2 months. And by expanding the supply of the ESD to the user who participate in economic incentive game, which is when the ESD trade below $1, there is an incentive to burn the ESD. So you acquire something called a coupon. And what you can do with the coupon is if ESD trade above $1 in the future, you can use it to redeem for more ESD. So let's say you burn one ESD, you can claim like 1.5 or 1.3 ESD in the future if ESD trade above par again when it go below par. So there's an incentive for the ESD participant to burn their ESD when it's below par to a certain extent so that they can get more ESD when it go above par again. And there is an expiry date to the coupon so that if it doesn't go above $1 within a certain time period, I think for ESD it's around 1 week, and then the coupon will expire worthless. So there is a lot of game theory component into ESD on how do they stabilize the price and bootstrap the initial value and the network effect of it. But another way to describe it is also highly speculative, and it's a bit of a game theory game in a way that you have to know what other people is gonna do so you can front run them a little bit to do something before they're gonna do it, and you also want to be the first one to exit when it trade substantially above $1 so that you can sell before it trade below $1 again. So there's a lot of speculative element into it, and I can tell a lot of people are very interested into it right now. Even people who I don't expect it to be participating in this kind of game. I have some professional traders, professional market maker, like in the professional trading firm. Yeah, they have also doing it on their personal account, which is to my surprise. Yep. I think that's all. I think probably have more to add on this as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, the idea of an algorithmic stablecoin is not bad, right? Because all money is kind of a money game. Where it's a shared belief, and we're definitely in the very early stages of figuring out which ones may or may not work. I think Ampleforth was an early project. I think mid-2019 it launched. It had some backers, so there's an investor allocation, and then it did an IEO on Bitfinex. I think it started at like 150 market cap and then went up slightly and then went down a ton all the way down to like 10 or 15 mil. And then this year with the usage of the Uniswap Geyser, where people supply Ample and wrapped ETH into a pool, that kind of stabilized the price and allowed it to start going through a expansion cycle, and it kind of did a 50x, I think, from the bottom in market cap. So obviously captured everyone's imagination, because people before this kind of assumed that this kind of algorithmic stablecoin wouldn't really work in practice. And I think that Ampleforth was interesting because it gave people some ideas of what works and what might not work. I think Yam, then I'd kind of consider in the same vein where they like the ideas of the rebase. But ironically now, I think they're actually considering taking out the rebase. So I think rebase, expansion, contraction, it's ultimately a double-sided sword. If you think you can create the mechanisms that incentivize people to kind of do the actions that would, and risk capital that ultimately brings stability to the stablecoin, then it's good. And if they can't, then you're probably not happy with the contraction cycles. So I think ESD and DSD should kind of be seen in that light, where they're trying to solve some of those problems that they foresaw and kind of saw bear out in the Ample case. But again, like even at the 500 mil market cap, like it remains to be seen exactly how it'll play out with the DAO in terms of coupons, right? In terms of how the game theory works, where does it make sense to just buy the coin itself, or does it make sense to play the coupon game where you're betting that it'll stay above that the TWAP will stay above a dollar? These are all things that this is so new that no one really knows how it'll accrue, but I think the fundamental idea of an algorithmic stablecoin is not a bad one. The key is to get a reasonable distribution of token holders that are not just trying to make a quick buck, but are trying to build something longer term that could be a decentralized money, basically.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, where I kind of disagree is the characterization as it being a stablecoin at all. I think that's the misleading part. Ampleforth is maybe the easiest to talk about. So if you look at Bitcoin, in Bitcoin, you always have the same number of coins in your wallet unless you spend them. But the price of these coins fluctuates in the open market. And Ampleforth flips that around, where the price of your coins is always a dollar, but the amount of coins in your wallet constantly fluctuates. So that's kind of what the rebasing mechanism does, right? And I feel it's very hard to argue that this makes your balance more stable, right? The balance fluctuates just as much based on market demand as it does with a coin like Bitcoin. So I don't think it's a scam or anything. It's just a scam if you sell it as a stable coin, because people who want to own a stable coin, they want the number of their coins multiplied with the value of those coins to be stable. They want neither one of them to be stable and the other not, right? You can think of both Ampleforth and ESD as like a base layer money, like Bitcoin, but where I kind of disagree is the way that it's being sold as a stable coin. So we talked about Ampleforth, right? But ESD, in ESD, not everyone's balances change all the time. So they go a step further. They kind of keep the balances of those who don't want to participate in kind of the economic game stable. They can just keep their coins either in their account or in the DAO. And then they kind of incentivize some people to reduce their balance by burning their coins in exchange for more coins in the future. And yeah, I mean, ultimately, if you want to argue that ultimately these coins can have both a stable balance and a stable amount, then I think that's just not going to work without some kind of backing. I think that's the real problem. Like, not really can you make money trading these, or can they go to like $1 billion in market cap and then maybe collapse and have a new cycle and so on. I think those things are all possible. But what I don't see is that you will eventually convince someone to hold these as an actual stable coin when there are also other alternatives like USDC, Tether, DAI, SUSD, and so on.
I have something to add, you know, is I used to be fairly skeptical of the algorithmic stablecoin model, because I just think that in practice, that's unlikely to work, because the problem is when it's below the peg, even if you believe it will go back to the $1 peg, that it can go way below the peg before it start going there. I mean, you can use some economic incentive to incentivize that, but is who is going to step in? I mean, nobody wants to step in earlier. I mean, everyone want to be the last person to support the price, and then I buy the bottom. I don't want to buy when it's going to drop another 20%. That's always a question with the algo stablecoin stabilization method, because you can't redeem it at par. But I think one thing changed my view on this is like, I've been reading Sapien. I know it's a very popular book, and I've been pretty late to this book. But it basically say that, you know, a lot of things is like it's homo sapien imagination. And I do believe that for money, there is some aspect to it. And I do think that some people might claim it, but I think a lot of the empty set dollar community do recognize that it's not going to be stable right now. But what they want to achieve is to use the speculative component of ESD to bootstrap the initial network effect to a certain level where that it can be more stable. They don't think it will be stable right now. They think that it will be stable when it hit like $5 or $10 billion market cap or even higher. I'm not sure what's the target right now, but I think that there's some possibility that it will happen there, but I don't think it is a very high possibility event. Again, and I also think that one key issue with the algo stablecoin is it might not be there when you need it the most. Because what happened is on the, like, let's say what happened to March this year, March 13 this year, when the crypto market dropped like 50 to 70% in a day for most. And I think in that moment, can algo stablecoin withstand the test of being stable on that kind of situation? That would be the greatest test to them. If they can't, I think the confidence will be destroyed in one single moment, because that is not there to be stable when you need them the most. Yeah.
I kind of think that the entire question of is it really a stable coin is almost irrelevant, because I think like everyone involved knows that it's a game of betting on is this game fun enough that the whole world will play it. Right,
it's a good way to put it.
It's like you know laugh and the world laughs with you, right? But cry and you cry alone. So right now they're trying to get more people to laugh with them, and I think they do recognize that if they can get more and more people on board, if the game is easier, if the game is easily understood, then they can expand that way. And you know, if people own a small percentage of their portfolio, in it, like, I did kind of, like, I was kind of drawn to the original Apple Forth idea, which is that this is a commodity money, which is very deep, you know, arguably less correlated with other crypto assets, right? Because it, yeah, like, if the whole market nukes 80%, then probably Apple Forth is going to nuke also. But, you know, in normal markets, it generally exhibits lower correlation. You know, it might be like 1.05 and then it might not rebalance, or it might be like 0.88. But the initial problem they had was like liquidity, and then later on they solved that with the geyser. So I think like algo stablecoins probably in the first chapter. I think they're the biggest issue I have them with them is just Gini coefficients. I think reality is that there's still not that many people involved in some of these, and I think the Gini coefficients are not great. So that kind of makes it like not a distributed enough game. But I think if you can properly distribute the game and you can then create the right crypto economic incentives, like you kind of need that mix of brain power and distribution, which is tough, right? Because I think, you know, ESD, they probably have the brain power, but they don't, I don't know if you can achieve the distribution and have those waves of, you know, coin distribution, profit taking, get it out. Because the way that the DAO locks everyone in, right? Like, kind of, it's kind of like a cartel, basically. Like, you kind of need no defectors, and so like, but then it makes it almost like irrelevant what the market cap is. Like, the market cap, you can call it 20 billion, but if everyone's locked in the DAO, then no one can, you know, it's only 1% of the people can ever crystallize that value. So it's like the market cap is almost like a marketing to get you to come in before it's, you know, before it's even higher. And kind of like you kind of say like all DeFi games can be reduced to FOMO 3D, right? Where you know that it's being programmed to go higher, each period. And so you're kind of having to decide, either you don't play at all or you play as early as possible. So I think like no one's really misled that it's actually a stablecoin, because if you thought it was stablecoin, you wouldn't buy it anyway, because you know, like you're trying to 5x your money, right? If you buy the stuff and then you play with it. And I think it's like, it's more Bitcoin like in that sense, where you're trying to make a bet that this is something that other people will like as a game. It'll eventually, because it's so fun, it'll become a money. And then because of that, it'll have better liquidity and then probably be less volatile, but it'll always be like a commodity like money, basically.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. I think it's exactly right to think of it as a commodity like money, same as Ampleforth, that has different properties from Bitcoin. I think where you're also right, I mean, equating like all money games in DeFi to something like FOMO 3D, right? I think many of the projects that we talked about like are not games, right? They are actually
products,
like legit protocols where like people interact with each other in a sustainable way. And like the more they interact with each other, the stronger they get. But here, these are games that have mechanisms that make the system inherently unstable. And that's kind of the whole point of it, right? That you have these waves of basically FOMO, people depositing, and you have these extreme incentives not to withdraw your coins. That's kind of the whole point. And ESD, it started with, I think, one epoch was 8 hours unbonding period for your coins in the DAO. And then they raised it for 15 periods, so 5 days. And I think that just shows that they were never interested in like making it more stable, because if you wanted actually to stabilize, to get the coin back to $1, then the method you would do that would be to bring more supply to the market, right? Actually, so you have the positive rebase, people in the DAO get more supply, and then those people can go to Uniswap and sell the supply. And that's what pushes the price back down to $1. But the way they are taking it is actually the exact opposite direction, right? They make it even harder to cash out to actually liquidate any coins. So you have this wave where like everyone's balances grow inside the DAO, but when they actually want to withdraw, then the price collapses to like 30, 40 cents. And the question is always, well, will those kind of expansion periods make up for the drop, or will there be an eventual time where it doesn't recover? And that you're exactly right, that this depends entirely on basically how much fun the game is to play, and if it can constantly find new money and new market participants to come in. So yeah, I guess those really don't have much to do with DeFi, in the sense, well, that those other protocols have. They do compose with other DeFi protocols, I guess, to a small bit. So kind of something like ESD and Ample. I think they both use the Uniswap V2 TWAP. As their oracle, so that's cool. But apart from that, yeah, I think it's good that we talked about it, because the hype for these things is really large right now. But yeah, I wouldn't really count them toward DeFi.
Yeah, I sort of agree. In a sense, you can say it's DeFi, but yeah, it's definitely a lot more speculative component into it right now than being used as like the product, like a goods and services. Yep.
So wrapping this up, so we covered all the categories. I'd like to spend a few minutes, where do you see DeFi going in 2021? We kind of covered like the categories that are like very obvious, kind of first satisfying the whole like speculative demand of the market. You have bridges, that the tokens to DeFi that exist outside of it. Then you have kind of the DEXs where you can trade them, and you have the lending protocols where you can lend them out, get some yield on them, others can borrow them. And then you have kind of the synthetics, it's where you also can deposit or use your tokens as collateral and then create like tokenized debt against it. So what is next?
I think one of the things that is like next, I think next year, or 2021, more use case will be unlocked in DeFi. I think right now we're only scratching the surface. We have built some of the basic base layer primitives like lending and borrowing, spot DEXs, some asset management protocol. But there are still a lot of other financial use cases that I think there's still a lot of room to grow and prove this potential. I think one of it is insurance. So I think right now only Nexus Mutual can claim to provide a successful insurance. I think that there will be more insurance protocol to emerge next year. And also like derivative. I think that a lot of the derivative trading use cases is hampered due to the performance issue of Ethereum blockchain. And I think that's on my count, there's at least 8 derivative trading protocol that is launching soon or already launched as well. So I expect this competition to be really heat up next year, and with combined with the launch of layer 2 solution, and hopefully they will also unlock some other use cases like some probably micro payment and or even under collateralized borrowing. I think this is something that kind of the holy grail of finance that a lot of people hope DeFi can achieve. Although it remains to be seen how it can be done, but I think there's actually, I think at least 2 or 3 protocol trying to tackle this issue, and they are gonna launch, I think, next year as well. And I think a few others, I think we're just gonna see it continue to grow, barring any regulatory actions. And it's also potential that we see some established fintech application tap into some of the product offering of DeFi to offer to their users. You can call it CDeFi, but probably bridging this to the mainstream audience as well through their fintech offering. I think that is also likely to happen. Yep.
Yeah, I'm excited to see DeFi derivatives really take off next year. I think there is a lot of pent-up demand to use these, a lot of pent-up use cases. I think if you think about existing DeFi with borrow and lending and kind of being able to draw against an asset, you can kind of generalize that to being long that asset as a perp, right, or as a future. So I think that being able to do so and then get the liquidation cost down very low, almost as low as possible, you then allow people to use it properly. So I would like to see transaction costs go as low as possible. I would like to see these kind of usability metrics really do really well next year, because I think that then the canvas for DeFi goes a lot bigger. So I think whether it's AMM or more central limit approach, I think once you have that and it's composable, you can, for instance, you can package a stablecoin that is like the coin plus its short perp. You can, you know, package a, you can, you know, have an options protocol which liquidates into a perp, or an aggregation of perps. There's all these things you can do, but step one is to just get the market actually liquid, get the market actually going. So fun to see.